How are you feeling after 7 weeks of lockdown? Speaking to many of you, I know that your experiences have been really, really different. For some of you, you have had all sorts of help and encouragement from family and friends. People have been providing the stuff that you need. And actually, an opportunity to slow down has been a real blessing. But for many others of you, it's become increasingly hard. You've still been working or perhaps haven't been able to work, and those pressures have been building up. For those of you who have been working, you're now trying to do that from home, surrounded by kids for whom the fun and novelty of being locked in the same house and garden for nearly 2 months has long since worn off. And you may be finding this lockdown increasingly hard. Now, if that's you this evening, I wonder whether, as you read through this passage, you thought, well, crumbs, at least my family life isn't quite as dysfunctional as this family. Because that's what strikes us when we read Genesis 25, isn't it? We begin with long lists of foreign-sounding names, and then we're just confronted with this seriously dysfunctional family. And they weren't even having a massive coronavirus lockdown to contend with. You get to the end of this text and think, how am I going to learn anything from this passage? How is this going to help me grow in my faith this evening? What I want to help you see this evening as we dig back into the book of Genesis, Lord willing, for the next 10 weeks, is that this section shows us God demonstrating his faithfulness. That's why we've entitled this part of our series, The Lord of History. History's unfolding before our eyes in these chapters. Not only are children being born and families are growing, but nations are being born from these children. And in and through and over all of that history and all of the obstacles that we're going to see in our text, all of the sinfulness, all of the disappointments, all of the flaws in these people, God is working in surprising ways to overcome every single obstacle and keep his covenant promises. That's what Isaac's family needed to know at this point in the story. When Moses first wrote this story down, as God's people had been rescued from Egypt and were on their way to the promised land, that's what they needed to be reminded of. And in different circumstances, but with similar challenges, that's what you and I need to be reminded of again today. God is still working in surprising ways to overcome every obstacle and keep his covenant. Now, if you weren't with us last year, the first 25 chapters of Genesis are full of God's promises and covenants. It began at the very beginning of time when the first man and woman, Adam and Eve, got everything wrong, turning their back on God's promises and his commands and being sent away from God. In that moment of rebellion and judgment, God gave them a promise that he would one day send a seed, an offspring, who would crush Satan. Generations later, by the time we get to Abraham, God is making even bigger and even more specific promises. Promises to make Abram into a great nation. Promises to bless all the nations through Abraham's, which means that that promised serpent crusher is going to come through Abraham's line. And as Abram dies and the story moves on to the next generation, we see God keeping his promises to Abraham's descendants. Now, we're not going to spend any real time in verses 12 to 19, but don't skip over them as a meaningless random list of names. That is the list of Ishmael's family. Ishmael was Abraham's son. If you go back to chapters 16 and 21, when Abram and Sarah were unable to have their own, Abram tried to force that blessing of God by having a son through another woman. Ishmael was born. God's blessing, his promised one, couldn't come through Ishmael, but God in his great kindness and grace still made promises to Ishmael. He promised to Abraham that Ishmael would be the father of 12 rulers. He promised to Hagar, Ishmael's mum, that he would be the father of a great nation. And what do we read in Genesis 25, verse 16? These were the sons of Ishmael, and these are the names of the 12 tribal rulers, according to their settlements and camps. You see, God always keeps his promises, even to families outside the covenant family of God. There were sons and sons and sons until they stop coming. Verse 19 begins the next big section in Genesis. It's going to take us all the way through chapter 25 to 35. It tells the story of Jacob's life. But as that story begins, we hit the first obstacle in verse 21. Because Isaac and Rebekah couldn't have any kids. If you look at verse 20, Isaac and Rebekah were married when Isaac was 40. You drop down to verse 26, and we see that they've been waiting for 20 years for a child. 20 years of monthly heartbreak and all of that seemingly unanswered prayer, while at the very same time, it seems that Ishmael's family are growing and spreading like wildflower. Now, of course, we've been here before. The story rings true if you've been with us in the book of Genesis, because Abraham and Sarah had to wait 9 whole chapters of Genesis, 25 whole years of their life before Isaac was born. But Isaac and Rebekah's situation is different because their response is different. This isn't Groundhog Day. Those of you who've seen the film will know that Bill Murray plays a weatherman who's sent off to go and cover the annual Groundhog Day at Punxsutawney in Pennsylvania. And he goes there for the big day on the 2nd of February. He does his job, he does all that he's asked to do. By the end of the day, he goes to bed, wakes up, and finds himself stuck in a time loop, living the 2nd of February over and over and over again. Now, when we read this familiar story of barrenness, it is not an endless repeat. Isaac and Rebekah have learned from their parents. They're not going to try and force the timing of God's promises. They're going to trust his provision. They're not going to try and do something immoral in order to force God's hand. What they do, look at verse 21, is Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife. Isaac trusted that God would overcome every obstacle in order to keep his covenant promises. God had promised to grow Abram's family through Isaac, and Isaac waited patiently for 20 years and prayed. Now, our circumstances are different to Isaac's. We don't have the same specific promises for children or even for marriage that Isaac had been given by God. But we do love and serve the same promise-keeping God. And even if we're holding on to different promises from God's word, we are holding on to the same promise-keeping God as Isaac was. Now, in God's grace, he answered Isaac's prayer. And after 20 years of waiting, we read his wife, Rebekah, became pregnant. But it was not plain sailing from there on. Verse 22, we hit our next obstacle of feuding siblings. Now, if you've got a brother or sister, you will know all about fighting with siblings. In your house, the fights might still be physical rough and tumbles, or you may have moved on to that war of words, and perhaps even with the passage of time moved on to years of silent treatment. All of that pulls families apart. But you look at poor Rebekah. She's experiencing this battle even before her boys were born. Verse 22 tells us that the babies jostled within her. That's a really gentle way of translating the Hebrew. What it literally says is they were crushing each other. I can still remember when Hannah was pregnant with our first. And as the pregnancy developed, with the passage of time, eventually I had that experience that every expectant dad has of seeing the baby move in Hannah's tummy with an arm or a leg giving a kick on the tummy, and you could see the bulge on the tummy. It's a really weird experience when you've never experienced it before. You think that's bad? Think about poor Rebekah. She's got two babies that she's longed for 20 years, finally alive within her, and they're crushing each other inside of her. Now, little surprise, she brings her doubt, her worry, her fear, her lack of knowledge to God and says, "What is going on?" And what does God say in verse 23? "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One will be stronger than the other, and the elder will serve the younger. Now, we read that and we are not used to thinking about one baby being the father of an entire nation. But we're not totally thrown by the idea that of two siblings, one of them would end up being slightly weaker than or serving the other one, who would be slightly bigger. But in Rebekah's day, the idea that the elder would serve the younger was totally foreign. They had really clear traditions, very, very simple rules that the eldest was born, and if there were any subsequent siblings, they would all serve and follow the lead of the first. That's not what God had planned. The elder will serve the younger. And when does God tell Rebekah this? It's before either of the boys have been born. God is showing us his sovereign control and his sovereign choice while they're still in the womb. And that's how God always works. When Jesus walked on our world, he told his followers in John 17, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." That's what Paul tells us in Romans 9 when he refers back to this very episode. Rebekah's children were conceived at the same time by our father Isaac. Yet before the twins were born or had done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose in election might stand, not by works but by him who calls, she was told, "The older will serve the younger." These unborn babies may have been crushing each other in Rebekah's womb, but God's plan and covenant is not going to be thwarted by two squabbling boys. And in fact, in the way that he would work through them, he would remind them that the God of history doesn't save anybody because of who they are, what they've done, or how they're going to behave. He saves them because in his unbelievable grace and mercy, the God of heaven chooses to love. Now, if you're a Christian here this evening, I hope that that truth fills you with joy and wonder and confidence afresh in your salvation this evening, because you never deserved it. I never deserved it. God chose to set his love on all of us who trust in Jesus, not just at the point that we were in our mother's tummies, but before the very beginning of time itself. Not because of anything in us, not because of who we might be, but because in his great grace he chose to set his love upon us. And that great comfort is something that nothing can shake from you. Not a lockdown, not any financial insecurity and fear that you may have, not any of the difficulties that may be brewing even in your own homes as we wait in this lockdown. God's love for you was established in eternity past because of his grace. And if you're not yet a Christian, can you see how God's grace is your great hope too? You may be sitting there thinking, "Well, I couldn't possibly be loved by God because I've done this or that, or because my bad ledger outweighs my good ledger." But the story of God's choice of Jacob shows you that the way you live your life is not your hope for salvation. Your hope for salvation is in a God who says, "I love to forgive. Now trust Jesus. He is the way I can forgive you." Now, back in the story, after months of this bruising pregnancy, eventually Rebekah finally gives birth to the twins. And even then, the boys are squabbling. The first has what we now call hypertrichosis, which means he was born with loads and loads of hair all over him. And he was red or ruddy in appearance, which is why they called him Esau, which means hairy. I don't think my girls would thank me if Hannah and I had named them after something that reminded us of the labor. But that's how babies were often named in Rebekah's day. And it's the same for the number two child who's born just seconds later, grasping after the heel of his brother. And so they called him Jacob because he grasped the heel. But you know, the fighting didn't stop there. It began in the womb, it continued even in delivery, and it didn't stop in the terrible twos. They didn't get past it in the grumpy teenage years. This rivalry, this battle, would continue for generations. You remember back in verse 23, God said that the two boys you have in your womb are not just children, they are the fathers of nations who will be at war with each other. Now you accelerate through the history of the Bible, and we're reminded of this again when Moses wrote this book for the first time, as the Israelites had been rescued from Egypt. They were on their way to the promised land, and one of the ways to get there safely and quickly was through Edom. So Moses sends a message to the king of Edom, Esau's descendant, and saying, "Can you let us through? Can you give us safe passage?" But Edom answered, "You may not pass through here. If you try, we'll march out and attack you with a sword." Accelerate a little further in Israel's history. They've got to the promised land. They've built the city of Jerusalem. They've withstood the Assyrian attack, and now the Babylonians are attacking them. And Psalm 137 tells us that the Edomites joined the Babylonians in pulling Jerusalem all the way down to its foundations. Then hit fast forward on the timeline again. You get to the birth of the Lord Jesus Christ. The promised seed from Adam through Abraham is finally here. Who is it who tries to kill the Lord Jesus? It's King Herod, who is himself an Idumean, a descendant of Edom. You see, this feuding that began in the womb, continued through their lives, throughout all of their generations, continued to be the story for the whole of Israel's history, because the serpent is always seeking to destroy the promised seed. But what do we know? We know that God always keeps his covenant promises. And he did it with Jacob and with the Jews and with Jesus. So God's faithfulness overcomes childlessness. It overcomes feuding siblings. But it will also overcome favoritism. These boys grew up to be as different in life as they were in their births. You look at verse 27, Esau's described as a skillful hunter, a man of the open country. He was an outdoorsman. In my mind, I picture him as a kind of eat your steak rare to blue with a knife the size of Crocodile Dundee who would win every single arm wrestle. That's my picture of Esau. And then in contrast, you get Jacob. And our text tells us that he was content to stay at home among the tents. That's a tricky verse to translate, but what is at the heart of the idea is that Jacob was a fine, well-cultured man. I picture him a bit like a young professional. He's got fitted shirts and skinny jeans, and when he goes to the art museum, he drinks peppermint tea. That's the kind of contrast I've got in my mind. Now, we hear those kinds of contrasts, and instinctively, we start to make value judgments, maybe even moral judgments. The narrator is silent, doesn't make any comment, just describes these boys with different personalities and different preferences. But for mum and dad, those differences spark a fire. A fire of favoritism because one prefers one over the other. Verse 28 tells us Isaac, who had a taste for game, loved Esau. More literally, what the Hebrew says is Isaac loved Esau because he put game in his mouth. But Rebekah loved Jacob. And that rivalry between mom and dad, that feud between those siblings, is going to drive the story of Genesis for the next 10 chapters. We know Adam failed by eating. We know Noah failed by drinking. We're going to see that Isaac failed by tasting. Can you see how everything's building up? If you're reading this story for the first time, the narrator is telling a story in a way that draws you in and sees all of these tension points bubbling up like a pressure cooker. And that is exactly what is about to start bursting out in our final obstacle, because we're exposed to their character flaws. Moses paints the scene for us in verse 29. Esau's been out hunting and he comes home to find that Jacob's got a stew on. Esau's hungry, like proper hungry. The translation says that he is famished. Literally, he is faint with hunger. In fact, being prone to exaggeration a little bit like me, he says that he's on death's door. But we know that he wasn't. We know that he wasn't, because if you go to the end of the story, you see that once he's had his fill, he ate it, he drank it, he got up and left. That is a speed of recovery you do not go through if you are on death's door. You see, what this story is really showing us is Esau's character. The real problem isn't the fact that Esau was hungry. The problem was that for Esau, the only thing that mattered was what is here and now and driving his passion and his heart. And when he finds Jacob, what he says in verse 30 is really coarse. He says something like, "Quick, let me gulp down some of that red stuff, red stuff." Literally, it's repeated for emphasis. That's how passionately consumed he is. "Let me gulp it down." And then we see Jacob's character. Here comes his brother out hunting, perhaps to kill the game that they were going to eat all together. And he's hungry. He's tired. Jacob sees that. He could just give him some stew. It's all prepared. But he doesn't. We start to see that actually his name was a clue for another part of his character. Because Jacob doesn't just mean he grasps a heel. It's an idiom. It's a turn of phrase for he's a deceiver. And Jacob sniffed an opportunity. He sniffed a moment of weakness in Esau like a shark sniffs for blood in the sea. Look at verse 31. "First, sell me your birthright." Now, given how hungry Esau is, even though he's not about to die, it sounds pretty unreasonable to us for Jacob to have demanded anything. But we probably don't get just how massive an ask this is, because we're not used to talking about birthrights. You see, in Jacob and Esau's day, a birthright was what belonged to the eldest son, and it entitled him to two things. Firstly, a double portion of the inheritance, which meant if you've got two boys, the first was going to inherit two-thirds of the inheritance, meaning this bowl of lentil stew that Esau was so desperate to get his hands on would cost him a third of the entire inheritance of Jacob's life. But secondly, the birthright also entitled the eldest to become their head, the leader of the family, for the rest of his life. And Esau's willing to just throw all of that away because he's so desperate for red meat, red meat. And yet, because this family is a family of the covenant, the birthright contains something infinitely more precious than either of those things. Through the birthright would come God's chosen seed. The promise that God had made from Adam through Abraham now in this generation belonged to him who held the birthright, and Esau was willing to throw it away. He didn't have the eyes of faith to see how precious God's promises are. So he trades his future, his entire future, for a bowl of soup and some bread that he gulped down and forgot in just a moment and left. Esau's character shows us that he didn't deserve the birthright. But here's our problem. Neither does Jacob. You look at the end of this story and Jacob doesn't come out smelling like roses, does he? He's a devious, self-serving schemer who will even manipulate his own brother's weakness and hunger in order to achieve and advance himself. You get to the end of this chapter and we are left longing for more. And that is why, over the course of the next 10 weeks, as we work through Jacob's life, we're going to keep having to step back and see God's sovereignty over this unfolding history. You see, God's grace is not only going to overcome every obstacle that stands in its way, God is going to change Jacob. He's going to change him from being a prayerless schemer into a prayerful man of faith. And that gives us great hope this evening. If you're a Christian this evening, I hope that as we've worked through this passage, you've been encouraged afresh to know that God's sovereignty is bigger than our failings. His plans are not going to be scuppered by any obstacle, by any physical obstacle or a natural thing like childlessness. His promises, his covenant is not going to be scuppered by relational breakdowns, be they the feuds and the battles of siblings or the favoritism within a family. And God's promises will not even be thwarted by our character flaws, because God graciously changes people. The amazingly good news about God our Father is that he is always ready to welcome us back. That's why the parable that we know as the prodigal son is such a precious story to so many people. If you know that parable, you'll know that of the two sons, the younger decides to demand his inheritance and go off and squander it in a distant land. Eventually, he comes to his senses, realizes what an idiot he's been, and that he could probably, possibly go back and work as a servant in his father's house. But before he even gets to the door, his dad, who's been watching, waiting for him to come back, goes running out to him, wraps his arms around him, and welcomes him back into the family home. Now, if you know the story, you know that at that moment, the older brother gets the grumps. How dare the father show that level of forgiveness to somebody who had ruined everything? He's left out in the cold. There's a big party going on, celebrating the younger son coming back. But the father goes out to the elder brother. He doesn't leave him in the cold. He goes out to him and he says, "My son, you are always with me and everything I have is yours." The father pleads with the elder brother, "Don't stay there. Come in. Come back." Can I plead with you this evening? If you perhaps can relate to something of Esau's experience and to this point in your life, you've turned away from, you've perhaps even started to despise the precious promises of God. Remember the story of the prodigal. God longs for you, for men and women and boys and girls to come back to him. And can I plead with you this evening to do what the father offered the elder brother? Don't stay like an Esau. Hear the grace of God and come back to him, even this evening. Because the God of heaven delights to show grace to me and to you if you will trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the theme of our closing hymn. You see, just like Jacob, we are all debtors to mercy alone. So of covenant mercy, we're going to sing. We know in our own hearts that we are just as flawed and sinful as Jacob, but because of Jesus' perfect life and death in our place on the cross, everyone who trusts in him now comes to the Father clothed in Jesus' righteousness, in his obedience and in his blood. And in that, we hide all our transgressions from view.